calling on her phone. I've got no time to be alone. Summer coming at me all the time. You better think I lose my mind. Cause I'm stranded on my own. Stranded far from home. Alright. I'm riding on a midnight train. But everybody do
the same.
Let's talk tunes. Hit record.
I haven't stopped recording. I fuck shit up like that. I'm fucking cooked. I've been at a conference all week and with thinking people really hard about thinky things, and I drank quite a lot of red wine at the thinky thing last night, and now I can't do any thinky things.
That's not good.
Talking about decolonizing things and fucking, you know, gender politics and, you know, all, you know, stuff that Jesus. A bogan from the sticks doesn't really get his head around.
I went to book club on Wednesday night and had to talk all thinky shit as well. I'm going, I don't know. I don't know. Don't ask me these things.
I was just glad to get home and found the thing on Twitter was some letter from the Chief Censor of Australia in the 90s that listed all the words you couldn't use. You couldn't use on posters on published material, and it was all like words from Picture Magazine, like smoo and fucking schlog and norks. It's like something out of a Larry Picker. He's like, careful, they're starkers, sort of shit. And I thought, yeah, this is my areas. This is much more my areas.
This magazine printed large.
Oh God.
Rogers Profanosaurus is what we need.
Yes. Anyway, this is the After Dark. We talk tunes. We have Albion Loveden with us as is our wont, and he has picked a couple of new albums for us to listen to. Should we start with the new one from Screaming Females?
We can.
Now, what did you? Is this a band that you've been following for a while, or is this sort of popped up?
No, I haven't at all, really. And I think actually your balls a couple of years ago might have put a couple of tunes in my head.
Yeah.
I think it was their last album, like 2016.
Yeah, maybe. Rose Mountain. Now, so we reviewed that in 16. And from memory of that, it was a pretty good album, but we kind of subsequently found out it was actually a 2015 album that they'd kind of repackaged and deluxe editioned and tour edition and stuff. So, it was probably a, you know, top quartile of the year album, at least for me. But it would, you know, it didn't sort of figure in the placings at the end of the year and sort of reckoning. How did you find, I was going to say All for One. It's not All for One. All was one.
All at once. I didn't mind it. Like I it's a big album. It's a huge album. I think it's actually a double album in old terms. If you were going to go and purchase it, you know, physical shop somewhere.
It's 50 odd minutes, I think.
Yeah. So that's a big album these days, I think.
Yeah.
Because of that, I think it suffers a little bit from, it might just be me, but attention deficit issues about halfway through. But, you know, up to that point, it's fucking
cool. I think they might have added a little bit. They might have been... I mean, I don't want everyone to release 40-minute albums because that's, you know, you don't really want cookie-cutter elements like that. Do you think they could have... You know, there might have been one or two tracks they could have shaved off and...
Yeah, look, I don't think there was much... There wasn't much narrative going on, I think, towards the middle three or four songs. It came back towards the end. I think there was definitely some bangers towards the end, but I think the first three or four songs, I think, were the album itself. I mean, there was you know, riffs for days. You just couldn't turn on a song without being slapped in the face by just this wall of her guitar. I can't remember her name, but... The wall of her guitar, and then
she's got a really distinctive sort of plaintive vocal.
Yeah.
And I mean, stylistically, it kind of goes from sort of punk to, I mean, there's always a little bit of hardcore. There's even some there's one track that kind of, it felt a little bit like kind of Arnhemmer era Tool. And there was other stuff that was, you know, almost, it almost had the fucking, you know, ostentatious cock rock kind of flourishes. Like the last song on the album, I think. Preposterous soloing and all kinds of stuff. And it was like that. I mean, it was all still stitched together in the same overall aesthetic, Drink, for those who are doing that sort of thing. But it was kind of variations on a theme, if you like. I actually really enjoyed this album. I wish I'd had more time to spend on it. Other than, you know, I only really got a couple of listens through it, unfortunately. But no.
Yeah, I'm a work listener, and it was hard to keep this on at work. I mean, I don't really work with young and vibrant people. It's a bit of an older crowd, so this was a hard album to keep on at work. But certainly, it was a great headphones album.
Yep.
And I think that Tool thing definitely pulls out for me. But I think the biggest one that it pulls out for me, and I hate to sort of bring the obvious, but her vocals are just absolutely garbage. They're Shirley Manson from Garbage.
I'm glad you qualified
that. I mean, that
vocals are shit house.
There's a Stone Temple Pilots song in there too. It wasn't the song from the Stone Temple Pilots, but it could have easily have been from any of the Stone Temple Pilots albums.
Yeah,
which was just on point for me. And I think it's called Glass House was the song that that was the poppy sort of Stone Temple Pilots song.
Yeah, there's sort of slightly epic scale post grungy sort of stuff, but it's they don't sort of slot easily into shoeboxes, which is one of the cool things about them. No, I really enjoy this album.
I think the producer really put his mark on it too. It was from Minus the Bear, Matt Bales was his name.
Okay.
From another sort of a punk or post-punk band called Minus the Bear, but he took on the baton from Steve Albini, who did the last two.
Oh, okay.
The last album that I heard was definitely an Albini mark all over that one. So I think it was a natural progression from that to what they're doing now. And I think, you know, from what I'm hearing, I think they're going to, this will be the album that will put them through to the mainstream. And I think there's two songs on there that will sort of make those tastemakers lists for this year. And I think that, you know, the Screaming Females is a name that will be on greatest hits of 18 lists towards it.
Do yourself a favor.
Go out and buy this one.
No, I enjoyed it more than Rose Mountain. So, and I quite enjoyed Rose Mountain. So, I will be getting the other regular half of the podcast to listen to this one so we can include it in discussions for end of year baubles and trinkets. So that was Screaming Females. The other new album that you pulled out was something of a departure for us, which is a bit of world music, a bit of Afrobeat with Femi Kuti. Now, how did you come across this fella?
African music I've been into for a little while. I think I actually think about it today. I think it was through. I think Angelique Kidjo was my gateway drug to African music, and she's not Afrobeat by any chance, by any stretch of the imagination. She's definitely more of a, if anything, Afropop, Western Africa type dance music. So she was the darling of Triple J. I'd say probably mid to late 90s.
Yeah.
And it was not my scene. Like, you know, I think any female artist at the time was certainly looked at with suspicion. And female world artist was looked at with some sort of askewed glance of stupidity. Oh, so
yeah, what are you doing on Triple J? This is where we play Regurgitator.
But those songs wangled their way in. There was probably three or four songs from the album Oremi, which sort of wangled their way in. And I've been a massive fan of hers since then. So that just sparks off, I guess, the quest for knowledge about African music. So I had no idea either. And I've been sort of following a few people since then. I think there's some Southern African rock bands have been coming out in the last sort of 10 years that have been pretty fun to watch, but that's not Afrobeat. Afrobeat is from a guy called Fela Kuti, who is same last name as a guy called Femi Kuti. So yes. Fela Kuti he was the inventor of Afrobeat, which is this extremely suffocating but thrilling beats-based rock and funk music that came up in the 60s and 70s, and it was he was from Nigeria. And he lived a life fairly akin to, and I guess on the same trajectory as Bob Marley, and the Wailers in Central America, and that sort of reggae scene.
It does feel kind of, there is sort of a Caribbean-ness to the way the beats kind of play out. It certainly feels like, not that they've been copying each other's homework, but there certainly feels like there is a commonality of at least the way the rhythms are kind of spaced out.
Yeah, and I think that very much was the case for his dad, Fela Kuti, yeah. And his band at the time was called Africa 70. And so the two kids, so he had two sons. I'm pretty sure he had more than those two kids, but the two sons sort of
understand
took it on.
He had a bit of a Wilt Chamberlain type lifestyle.
He died doing what he loved. I think he was fairly high and possibly with a lady of the night when he passed on. But he passed on the baton, his musical baton, to his two sons, so Femi Kuti and his other son, or his youngest son, Siyun Kuti, who both played with Africa 70. And since then, Siyun has taken on the baton of Fela Kuti with his new band, with Egypt 80. But I guess stylistically, it sort of transferred more to Femi, which is more of that aggro, politically charged. Yep. Extraordinarily forthright lyrics and forthright music that Fela was famous for.
Yeah, certainly it's almost like beat poetry, you know, or like Public Enemy hip hop rhymes.
Yeah,
and the way it's almost just the narrative that he pushes through. I know was it Bob Log the fourth on the Twitter machine. Sort of was noting the fact that the sort of very socially aware discussions. On the first track, it's almost like a kids get off my lawn moment, where he's talking about how, you know, the exchange rate in Nigeria used to be this, and you know the standard of living used to be this, and now it's you know, it's quite it is a little bit, you know, it was all trees around here, and you could get, you know. He gets, you know, I fastened an onion to my belt, as was the tradition at the time.
Can you believe there was a time in Nigeria the exchange was $2 to $1? Cost of living was cheap, education at all levels was also free. That time $1 not plenty money, 1,000 don't make you feel like king. $250 go fly you out of the country. Nigerians were profiting from the oil, many jubilating on the dance floor. Our father Fela cited corruption and warned against economic destruction. Say with all our oil money, too many Nigerians were suffering and poor. Instead, make our leaders.
Well, I think this album's a lot more peaceful than the last. I've really only been sort of following him since 2008, probably. And certainly the 2010 album Africa for Africa was a massive slap in the face for me in terms of following African music. So it was extraordinarily forthright. It was about you know, autonomy. It was about basically what's going on in the world.
Yep.
This one has pulled back a bit. I think you guys spoke maybe late last year with that monstrosity Rage Against the Machine / Ice Cube band that was out there, and how the politics of now has really been hard to translate into artistic aspect. I think that's because we're in the now. I mean, we're talking about obviously Trump. We're talking about, you know, the massive shift to the right in most Western countries, which has a huge obviously world effect. It has a world effect on Africa as well.
Yeah.
I think sort of those older bands, and certainly Femi Kuti and Siyun Kuti, are getting to that age now where their politics is possibly 15, 20 years too old for what the current problems are being faced. So
yeah, that was certainly what we said about the Prophets of Rage, and that was, you know, there was a supergroup with REM and Carrie Brownstein from Slater Kinney. It was the other one. It was Karen. It was the same kind of thing. It was, you know, as we said on the show, your generation is the ones who've put these dickheads into power. You had your opportunity to solve this and you didn't actually manage to do it. Now, obviously, Femi Kuti can't solve African political corruption and the, you know, erosion of democracy by militarization on his own, but neither can I. So clearly it's more his fault than mine.
Yeah, and I think there are touches of that on this album, and certainly that lyric that you just gave out, the militarizing democracy, is a great song. It's a great lyric. Mm. But I think there's a massive tilt in this one to more of a an introspective look. I think there's a lot more love songs, and I love songs, for want of a better word, but you can, whatever you can do, an Afrobeat is a love song. But you know, very much more introspective. I think you certainly had the peace pipe on overdrive for, for the recording of that album. So
there's more stories about improving yourself, and there's more stories of the personal, and less stories of the you know, it's almost like the frame of reference of the album. Shit, I've been hanging out with fucking Signs and Stones. Shouts to you people, you know who you are. We need to decolonize the space. And that's kind of why why I enjoyed this album more than, say, with Bizarre has inflicted other Brass albums, and you referenced this earlier in the week with a tweet that, you know, you've managed to sneak in an album that's entirely Brass. And I note on Spotify's on the bio that that Femi holds the record for the longest continuous note played on a saxophone. It's like 51 minutes something. So he is a sax pest. But the authenticity of this is what makes it different from some of the other Brass laden stuff that Bizarre has inflicted upon me and the listeners of this podcast. It is.
Look, I think there's a Brass band. I mean, you can have a band that has Brass connected to it, which sometimes sounds great if you use it in highlights. If you don't sort of make it the be all and the end all, but then Afrobeat by its very nature is Brass led. So beats and Brass led. You don't have Afrobeat without the beat. You don't have the Afro for that matter. So so from that perspective, I mean, it doesn't overbear. I mean, you're sitting there listening to probably 10 to 15 different instruments at a time in this suffocating, circular, no holds barred rhythm that just doesn't let you go for 4 or 5 minutes, and you can't think of anything that's more pleasurable than that in those 4 or 5 minutes. And I think that's that for me speaks volumes. I can't turn it off when it's on. The album goes on from the first one, and it plays right through to the end. I can't. There's no way I can turn that off.
Well, there is, but it involves getting up and unplugging the stereo.
Yes.
But, you know, what you're saying is you don't want to because you're enjoying it.
It's a fun album.
Yeah. It's completely outside my frame of reference, so I can't tell you, dear listener, whether this is good or bad, Afrobeat, which is why we have Albie and London here.
I think it's...
But I can tell you it's enjoyable.
Yeah, it's enjoyable. And I think, if you want the harder edge... Afrobeat, which is certainly enjoyable too, but it's not where my space has been the last sort of couple of months. But his brother Siyun Kuti also released an album this year with Egypt 80, which was Fela Kuti's his dad's band. So he's now the leader of that band. They're all legendary African musicians in their own right, and they still tour. And he's released an album as well, which is a lot more politically charged and a lot more in your face. A lot more angry. The vocals are a lot more, righteousness than what Femi's is in this album.
Cool. So those are the two new albums that we were talking about in this episode. You also picked us a classic album, and this is an album that's been in a, I wouldn't say a blind spot, but it's been on that kind of long list of albums that I really should go and listen to, and that is the Saints' debut album, I'm Stranded, from 1977. Now, the Saints were a Brisbane punk band who continued to be a Brisbane band, but not a punk band, and then stopped being a band entirely. Well, at least the major players involved, Bailey and Cooper, stopped wanting to be in a band together. This is an iconic moment in Australian music evolution. There was a whole generation of kind of Australian garage punks, for want of a better phrase for them, that were kind of led by the Saints and Radio Birdman, and they continued on a whole sort of generation of bands that followed through, that led to the evolution of bands like the Hoodoo Gurus, who don't sound like the Saints, but a lot of the guys, the tutelage guys who were in the Gurus, were in bands that sounded a lot like the Saints and Birdman, and in fact were in spin-off bands from Birdman, at least. How did you come to the Saints in the first place? Was it just a Brisbane thing? Or?
Yeah, look, just a Brisbane thing. It's one of those albums that you just kind of go, you know that it's big, you know that it's, you know, obviously it was released when we were either not born or very, very young at the time that it was released. Yeah. So I didn't experience it when it was out, and certainly wasn't in my realm of family or friends when I was growing up. I probably didn't know the Saints until I moved to Brisbane at all in any way, shape or form.
I think my entry point to the Saints was probably the fact that the video for Know Your Product used to get picked by guest Rage programmers all the time. Like, they'd get bands in and to program Rage, and they, because it was Australia, they'd almost always pick the video for Know Your Product. In fact, I think there was a Rage compilation CD they put out, which was the most commonly played videos by Rage guest programmers, and Know Your Product was on that. Now, Know Your Product's from a couple of albums subsequent.
Yeah. So the next album, Eternally Yours, it was from.
Yeah,
but this album was, moving to Brisbane, sort of, became a music journalist in Brisbane, so it's a very parochial scene. You tend to have people yell at you in terms of what you should know and what's important about the Brisbane music scene. And this is one that's always been thrown at me. So, I think Andrew
Stafford?
Pig City, yeah.
Yeah, Stafford.
Andrew Stafford. He wrote eloquently many times about the Saints. And I guess the mindset, or what I couldn't really get through my head, is how important they were at the time, because they probably weren't that important in world music, but they came up at the same time as the Ramones and the Sex Pistols.
Yeah.
So the Sex Pistols in England, the Ramones in New York, and the Saints in Brisbane, and I'm sure others around the world too. But they were all germinating around the same time,
yeah,
and all growing in the same way, but not with any reference to each other. So yeah,
they all happened to share the same source material, which was pretty much the MC5 and the Stooges, particularly the Stooges' Raw Power. And that, Raw Power, there's so much Raw Power on this album, and I mean that literally and metaphorically. There's so much of that massive, that huge, ugly, resounding electric riffage. It feels so much like, and Raw Power is one of my favorite albums. And it's one reason I've obviously really enjoyed exploring this particular album.
It's a weird album, isn't it? Because it's landed by, or it starts off with that song, which everyone knows, it's Unstranded, and it's the name of the album, and it's
title track,
the first song of the album, which is obviously in 40 years hence, we've shied away from playing the killer tune first up. We tend to bring it into three or four songs down the track to hook people in, but it starts off with that song,
they did back then. I mean, we talked about this when we did we reviewed that Judas Priest album, and also the Hendrix Experience. They always put the lead single first on the track list, and it would depend what market you were in. Like, the American release would have a slightly different track list because they had put the single that was the most successful over there to open up the album.
And I think that from there, it's pretty suffocating, the entire album. Yeah. It's hard to sort of get away from Ed Cooper's guitar for the entire thing. And there are low moments. Like, it's not entirely all,
it's not all thrash. It's not all fucking pedal to the metal. So my entry point, as I said, the entry point to the Saints originally was Know Your Product. But about probably 15 years ago, I think, there was that, that new rock revolution, whatever you want to call it. Those bands that were, everyone from the White Stripes to the Hives to the Strokes and all that sort of stuff. And of course, there was a large Australian New Zealand contingent, and the New Zealand contingent were bands like the D4 and the Datsuns, bands like that. The D4 covered a couple of songs off this compilation that came out, that was sort of highlighting Australian garage punk of the late 70s through to the middle 80s. And this was called Do the Pop, which was named after a Radio Birdman song. So there was a lot of kind of Birdman, Saints, early stuff, and then the bands that kind of evolved in the scene subsequently. So on the D4's second album, they covered the Lime Spiders' Out of Control, and they covered the Hitmen's Savage. That was a band that had Brad Shepherd, future guitarist of the Gurus. But on that compilation is I'm Stranded, but also One Way Street, the second track on this album. And One Way Street is my favourite song on that entire Boom Pop compilation, just because of its unremitting high voltage obnoxiousness. I love the power and the anger and the there's so much. It is really what punk rock is. The whole fucking force behind that, and the disillusionment, and the Tism said in that they're talking about. Paul McCartney once said the Sex Pistols were another band playing Chuck Berry. They're playing Chuck Berry, but fuck, they're playing it in a way that Chuck Berry wasn't playing it. So
and I think Ed Cooper on Chuck Berry's guitar would be an interesting
yes,
interesting prospect. I think.
Yeah, but obviously, the 1-2 punch of those two songs hooks me in as someone who loves that kind of proto punk sound of the 70s. You know, I love Never Mind the Bollocks. Not so much for all the stuff that goes around punk, you know, Mohawks and, you know, the Jubilee and, Sid Vicious being a complete cockhead. It was just the riffs and the vocals and the snare.
That comes through this as well, and I think that One Way Street is also, I think we're Kissing Cousins as well, it's got that bawdy, tongue-in-cheek, almost, it's innocent now, but...
it feels very Queensland.
Yeah, extremely so.
It's almost like they were taking the piss out of the stereotype of where they're from. I mean, it's funny, we were talking about the fact that that there aren't very many, because I think it was it when we had you on last time? Because we had you on for the 100th episode of After Dark. And I think we talked a bit about the Brisbane songs thing, because there was that fairly ropey list of the best Brisbane songs. And one of the problems is that a lot of the best Brisbane bands don't write songs that are deliberately autobiographical about the city. And I think there's nothing in this album that says we're in Brisbane, but there's everything about this album that says we're living in a hillbilly dictatorship and we have no prospects and no future, and all the same stuff that the Sex Pistols were saying, pretty much.
And I hear that, though. I hear that through that guitar and through the bass as well. For me, that just, I know that some people say it's synesthesia, but people can see colours. I can't see colours, but I definitely get visions of, I guess, scapes or landscapes or streetscapes when I hear a certain type of music. And this says to me it's a tin roof shimmering in the heat. It's absolutely, the guys that are playing this are fucking sick of it. It's, the end of January, they've had 3 months of that Brisbane, ball sweat fucking bullshit going on for 3 months. They fucking hate it. They hate their life. They hate their world. The only way they can express that is by plugging in a guitar and turning it up fucking loud.
Yeah.
And thrashing the shit out of it for underneath the Queenslander for 4 or 5 hours at a time.
And it is a harsh metallic guitar tone on purpose.
Mm.
And that's kind of and obviously Bailey's vocals are a harsh, guttural
sneer.
Yeah, it's that punk rock sneer. And as you said, the most remarkable thing is that it's not as though they listened to the Sex Pistols and said, "Let's do that." These bands, I mean, the Ramones were slightly earlier, but I mean, are you going to find a Ramones album in Brisbane in 1975? I mean, how? Maybe. Maybe it gets there. Maybe it doesn't. Joe's not letting that much shit through. Mm. So it's remarkable that the starting material, seems to have been common, but it all kind of ended up the same. It was like convergent evolution. You ended up with the same endpoint or a similar kind of endpoint from in totally different locations all around the world.
Well, what was interesting too is where that went from there. So, the Sex Pistols obviously imploded pretty quickly.
Yeah.
The Ramones continued on with the same song for 20 years. They just played the same song the same as AC/DC, just in different keys, for the rest of their lives. Whereas the Saints, the second album, the third album were completely different.
Yeah, they got out of punk real quick. And then they split up. Well, at least Bailey and Cooper split up.
They're still together. I mean, Bailey still has the Saints name, and he still puts musicians on it and releases albums. Not to release albums, but
and Cooper tours as the Aints, which I think is a lovely piss take. But apparently they were both doing like independent 40th anniversary tours last year of this album.
Yeah, right. Well, and then I think Andrew Stafford actually wrote about and saw that Pig City gig that I missed, unfortunately. I missed that gig, but they reformed that old lineup of Ivor Hay and Ed and Chris Bailey, and they played at UQ, which, for all intents and purposes, you know, set the world alight, you know, 40 years or 30 years later. But then reformed again 2 years later to do another gig at in Brisbane, which I saw, and it was a shambles, absolute fucking shambles. Mm. I've never seen a more embarrassing show in my life, and I sat there really feeling for the likes of Ed and Ivor for, you know, getting up the balls to do this when Chris was just taking the piss out of it completely. But yet they still maintain their thing. You know, Ed Cooper still does the Saints work.
Yeah.
So does Chris Bailey. Like, they go out and do it. So
the Aints play the Saints was I saw as of the end of last year, they were doing their competing, you know, Australian Saints shows, which is a little bit unseemly. It'd be better if they would be able to do it in the same room. But I mean, the story of Brisbane male singer combinations is that they often don't want to be in the same room together. I mean, the classic album that you picked last time you were on the show, the Go-Betweens, there were two gentlemen who didn't really want to be in the same room together anymore.
For a while, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So get that Brisbane piss into you and you just don't want to hang out with anyone anymore.
And then Powderfinger do it, and probably four albums too late decide I don't want to be in the room together.
Yeah, they should. Did Powderfinger reform for the Commie Games thing? I didn't actually catch the end of it because it bored me to tears.
No, I don't think so.
Nah, I thought they might have gotten back together again to
some lady do a John Farnham thing, which was bizarre.
Christ!
John Farnham was Brisbane, was he, or Gold Coast?
No. He had a mullet, so he would have fitted in on the Gold Coast. You know, you had that Warwick Kappa shit going on, but it's a joke. Joke of a sports carnival, not one you need to worry about too much.
But this album was not a joke. It was I thought it was interesting. I haven't listened to it all the way through. I've never actually put it on and played it all the way through. But I found it enjoyable. Found it really quite fun. I think the second album and the third album were a lot better. I think the songs were probably a bit more advanced coming to the third album, but then they just imploded pretty quickly after that.
No, so. I really like the rawness and the urgency of this. It's it fits into a. It fits into a template, and I can see why these guys and Birdman were, although they weren't massively successful overseas, they were held up as being pioneers of this sound, which went on to influence so many other bands, which is why, you know, overseas acts come over and want to pick, you know, they wanted to program Saints stuff for where they had a chance to program Rage. So brings us back to the start of the story again.
Indeed.
That was fun. All right. Thanks for joining us this week. That's been lovely to have you on. Next week, Beezer will be back, and we're doing Jack White's new album. Yeah, I know. We're doing Everything Is Recorded by Richard Russell, and the classic album is The Black Crowes America.
Because I
couldn't remember the name of the one from 92. So the Southern Music and Harmony thing. But America's got the cover with the pubes on it, which is a good enough reason to pick that one. But just want to say thanks to Albion Lovedon for joining us this week. And we'll have you on again because you're pretty good at this sort of thing. if you want it. But until that, we'll catch you next week.